Thank you very much, Lynn. Happy Mother's Day, everyone, and welcome to the 7 Steps sharing. I'd also like to remind you that today, immediately following the 7 Steps sharing, we're going to have our first Awakening Together minister ordination ceremony. We have 5 people being ordained this evening, so if you can hang around and support them while they're being ordained as Awakening Together ministers, that would be terrific. Thank you, Monica, for saying Happy Mother's Day. So what I would like to do, just as a point of stillness, is play a song before we get started. And the song that I'm going to play this evening is called Lady Lavender, and it is by Denise Hagen.
May truth be beside you, truth be before you, truth be behind you, as queen of your heart. May truth be the vision in eyes that see you, in ears that hear.
So again, welcome to the 7 Steps to Awakening, and I'm putting a link in the room right now. This link goes to number 643 in my 7 Steps journal. What I'll be doing, of course, is reading the quotes from the book, The 7 Steps to Awakening, and then after looking at the quote in the book, I will go and read from my journal. So that's the link to the journal. And if you have the book, The 7 Steps to Awakening, you can follow along. If you, by the way, don't have this book and you would like to get it, you can find it on Amazon.com. Right now, I'm in step 3 of The 7 Steps to Awakening. And the quotes that I'm reading are from Yoga Vasistha, the Supreme Yoga. And this is quote 643. Be established in truth and live in freedom in a mindless state. Again, the quote is, "Be established in truth and live in freedom in a mindless state." And when I read this quote today, the first question that arises in my mind, often when I'm contemplating a quote, what happens is inquiry will happen. Questions will start to come. And that's what just now happened as I read this quote. A question came. And the question that came was really, what is a mindless state? And in fact, somebody asked me that question a few weeks ago when I was in New Jersey. This person is heavily involved in the Oneness Blessing. In fact, I think that she has probably achieved one of their top certifications there. I think you can be certified awake, and I've been told that she was certified awake by the Oneness Blessing Organization, whatever they are called in India. And so she's very familiar with them, and she said that sometimes when she's there, they bring up on stage these people that are, well, they're in such a mindless state that, you know, probably a judgmental person would point at them and say that they were an idiot. You know, they're in such a mindless state that they have to be helped up on the stage. I think they have to be fed. There's nothing practical there. There isn't the practical day-to-day mind. And I think she was a little concerned, actually, that that's what is meant by quotes like the one we're reading right now from Yoga Vasistha, "Be established in truth and live in freedom in a mindless state." And when I ask within, what is a mindless state? The answer that I get is it's a state, well, first of all, we're not identified with the mind. We don't think the mind is what I am. But also, all of that needless chatter is gone. It's the mind in that way has become completely quiet. I mean, I don't know if you've ever paid any attention to your mind. Hopefully you have. And I don't know if you've noticed that when you are doing things that don't really even really require the intellect at all, you know, like maybe you're doing dishes and you don't need to think about doing dishes, you can just do them. Or maybe you're brushing your teeth and you don't really need to think about brushing your teeth, you can just brush them. The mind is talking the whole time, you know, it's just chattering. And when I ask within, what is the mindless state, I see a state without that chatter. I do not see a state where the body is unable to drive a car, feed itself, talk to another human being in a rational way. You know, the practicalities. Go on Expedia, book a plane ticket, get to the airport on time, get on the plane by oneself. In fact, very, very, very early on when I was on the spiritual path, I came across such a person who seemed to give up all practicalities. And I experienced some fear around that, probably like this person was, you know, when she said she had seen these people on stage in India. And when I closed my eyes around seeing this person who had just lost all sense of being able to function as a person in the world, and I closed my eyes and I asked about that, what immediately came to my mind were people that I had had great faith in as truly enlightened beings, truly walking wisdom. And what I saw in each of these people is that the practicality was still there. I saw that I didn't have to fear becoming a bumbling idiot that was unable to function in the world. But I can also see how, you know, even though the practicality may be there, I can see how there's a lot of mindlessness that needs to happen. In other words, there's a lot of chatter that is absolutely unnecessary. And so I'm very, very, very grateful that this mindless state is not only a possibility but a promise. It seems to me that the mindless state is what I would call absolute clarity. Open, available clarity. And so I read Yoga Vasistha, be established in truth and live in freedom in a mindless state. And what I hear in that is that absolute clarity without the distraction of unnecessary mental chatter, which most mental chatter is absolutely that. In fact, all mental chatter is absolutely that. But the mind does seem to sometimes still be a useful tool. In fact, the recording that Lynn played this morning, Ken Wapnick kind of addressed this as well a little bit. You know, that there are some practicalities in the mind. I don't remember his specific examples, but it might have been like being able to drive a car. He said something about if we forgot the past entirely, we wouldn't be able to get dressed, I think he said. That's a practicality, knowing how to dress yourself. So I see that those practicalities can be present. And yet there's just so much of what goes on in the mind that is absolutely unnecessary. It is pure distraction, and it keeps us from realizing our truth. And in that way, it seems very, very helpful to pray for the mindless state, the state without that distracting mind, that unnecessary mind. Lynn is quoting Michael Langford right now. Ending the ego does not end the body. After the ego ends, the body will live out the natural course of its life. And again, the practicalities that are needed will be there. It seems like it was probably Ramana Maharshi that I read. Somebody had questions along this line, and Ramana Maharshi said something like, you know, do not worry, the body will do what the body needs to do. Yeah, and Lynn says, Nisargadatta says the same thing. And so why we have some people that occasionally when they are on this spiritual path, why they come to this idiotic state, what happens when they let go of the mind that they come to this idiotic state, I can't answer. I will tell you my sense. If you're willing to take this with a grain of salt, mean I don't know. My sense is that is an extreme form of denial. It's a pretend awakening, a lie that they are themselves believing, and it's an extreme form of denial. That's my sense. The person that I met that went into this, there was just something in me that just knew that something was wrong here. Peace Pilgrim is a good example of practical, reasonable awakening. And she did a lot of things. She had no fear. She did a lot of things that many people would even say wasn't practical. You know, like she had no home. She had no money. She wandered around. You know, some people would say that's very dangerous what she did. But that's not true. There was an absolute wisdom, practicality in her. No fear, but an absolute practicality. She was able to, you know, to function. See, Lynn is also quoting, she says, in the Course, Jesus says, I will substitute for your ego if you wish, but never for your spirit. I can be entrusted with your body and your ego only because this enables you not to be concerned with them. and lets me teach you their unimportance. All right, so let me read 6:43 one more time, and then we'll go and look at the journal. Be established in truth and live in freedom in a mindless state. One more time, I feel like reading that. Be established in truth and live in freedom in a mindless state. All right, so when I go and look at the journal entry is just as short as the quote. Find that which does not change, that which is constant, always present self. Abide there. Find that which does not change, that which is constant, always present self. Abide there. Of course, what happens for all of us, I mean, you know, until it doesn't anymore, what happens is we do have this mind that is chattering and going in all directions, and as long as we are fully identified with that mind, we follow it. We follow it. And we could be standing at the sink doing dishes, right? Just standing at the sink doing dishes. And the mind could be going off into some fear story like, oh no, you know, what's going to happen if I run out of money, or what's going to happen if I don't get this job, or what's going to happen if I lose this job, or what's going to happen if this person I'm in a romantic relationship, you know, starts to get to know me better and doesn't like me, or whatever. And we can be standing at the sink just doing dishes on a perfectly fine day, and we can start to feel that fear. I have a friend who at one time was fearful about her future, primarily related to the economics of it. And she was staying with her sister, and she was sitting on her sister's sofa, just shaking with fear, you know, listening to the mind, where the mind was talking about, you know, whatever it was talking about regarding this story. And she's shaking and shaking with fear. And her sister, who isn't even on the spiritual path, came up to her and said, you know, what's wrong? What's wrong? And she says, I'm just so afraid. I'm just so afraid. And her sister says, why? All you're doing is sitting on the sofa. All you're doing is sitting on the sofa. You know, sometimes the wisdom can come through someone who doesn't have the intellectual knowledge of the spiritual path. What her sister was telling her was, you know, come back to this moment. Right here, right now, you're just sitting on the sofa. You know, she was off in her mind in some mental story and being afraid, you know, experiencing extreme fear, when all she was doing was sitting on the sofa. The same thing happened to me when I had that guidance to leave my job in Massachusetts and move to North Carolina. Some of you may remember I put my house up for sale, and I sold my house on the very first day when I was in Massachusetts. And then I went down to North Carolina for a weekend to find a house, and I couldn't find a house. The houses that I saw, I was planning to pay cash for a house because I knew I wasn't going to be working. And the houses that I saw that were within the range of what I could pay cash for needed serious work. And once I paid the cash for the house, I wouldn't have had the money for the serious work. So I just couldn't. And I spent the weekend looking at houses, and I couldn't find anything. And it was Saturday, late Saturday afternoon, probably 4, 5 p.m., maybe even 6 p.m. And I was supposed to be leaving at 10 a.m. the next morning to go back to Massachusetts, and I didn't have a house. And the same thing happened. This fear set in. In fact, it was one of the strongest fear experiences that I ever had. And, you know, the stories in the mind were saying things like, well, you know, you had a good job, you had a good position in Massachusetts, and you've just, you know, you've just thrown it away for all of this spiritual crap. You know, and I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, oh my God, I screwed up. I screwed up so bad, you know, by believing all this spiritual stuff, and I threw away a really good life, and now I'm going to be homeless, and, you know, and I was really scared. And I was actually at my brother's house, sitting on the front lawn, experiencing this fear, and a friend of mine, again, not on the spiritual path, a friend of mine I hadn't seen in 25 years or more, a friend of mine from high school came by and asked me what was wrong. And I told him my story. And he said to me, "Regina, everything's all right. You just don't know that yet." And I recognized that that was wisdom coming through this friend of mine. "Regina, everything's all right. You just don't know that yet." So you see, when we believe the mind's stories, you know, we really are thrown about. We're thrown about to and fro. I mean, sure, sometimes the mind is telling us these, you know, wonderful fantasy stories where we feel all warm inside and we really like it. But then other times there's these fearful stories, and there's these stories about how unworthy we are and how guilty we are and unskilled we are, and you know, we're just thrown about. And if you notice the mind, you'll notice there's nothing constant about it. There's nothing constant about it. I think it was probably last week during the Seven Steps teaching, I have a memory of recommending an exercise where you write down on the calendar before you go to bed what your primary mental concern was for the day. And then the next day, write down that day's mental concern. And the next day, write down that day's mental concern, et cetera, for a full year. And then in the second year, each day, first go ahead and look at your mental concern for the day, but then look at last year's mental concern. Notice how forgotten that is. Whatever, you know, in most cases, whatever last year's big story was on the same day that we were all worked up about, it's nothing. It's nothing today. Today's a whole nother story. So the mind has a way of causing us, of leading us to always give it attention, always give it attention. But that's really all the mind is doing. It's really just seeking our attention, and it's just telling whatever story we will listen to. And the wisdom in us knows that what we want to do is stop giving that attention to those stories. And again, find that which is in us, which is consistent. And learn to stay with that. Find that in us which is always the same. It does not shift and change. In fact, whether I'm listening to a story that's causing me to feel all warm and happy, or listening to a story that's scaring the crap out of me, this is the same. And when I can find it and then learn to kind of rest with it, be with it, something consistent starts to arise in me. And in fact, what begins to happen, what I begin to notice is that, you know, someday something does happen. It seems to be actually occurring. It's not a mental story. I mean, you know, not in the same way mental chatter is. It seems to be occurring, and yet I'm very consistent in being with it, in doing whatever needs to be done, in making whatever phone calls need to be made or whatever. I remain consistent even in dealing with something that appears to be upsetting, something that I know would have upset me before. So as I focus on the consistent, I also begin to come from that consistence. In fact, at some point, it's even more than consistence. It's just joy. It's like nothing touches the joy. You know, I have observed myself on many occasions saying things, you know, I can't think of a specific example. I'm getting worse and worse at thinking of specific examples, but let's imagine that I hired a workman to do a particular job, and what he did was really, it just really wasn't okay. It needed to be done again. I have observed myself, you know, looking at the person, you know, with an absolute smile in my heart and an absolute smile on my face and saying, well, you know, that's just not going to work. This is going to have to be done again. because, you know, that's not going to pass inspection or whatever, without any judgment, without any fear, without any anything, and yet still able to be with the situation, deal with the situation. This is what the consistency can do. As I was saying before, there's a great practicality in it. There's, you know, it's not becoming a bumbling, denying idiot with my head buried in the sand, unable to face whatever circumstances come that need to be faced or do whatever jobs that come that need to be done. There's a great practicality in it, and yet a great consistency and a great joy and love and non-judgment. So again, the journal entry for 6:43 says, "Find that which does not change, that which is constant, always present self. Abide there." And of course, in the beginning, when we have the desire to abide there in that constantness instead of in the shifting, changing, throwing us about mind, in the beginning, it's a learning project. We may be able to abide there for a short time, and the next thing we know, we're right back in the mind again. But I think that's okay. I mean, that's the way we learned to walk too, wasn't it? Didn't we stand up and take a step and fall down and stand up and take a step and fall down? But we just kept trying, and now we're all masters at walking. Most of us can even run, skip, jump, right? Walk backwards, roller skate, ride bicycles. You know, we can do all kinds of things. We're masters. And so we can become masters of this too. We just need to start where we're at and just keep practicing, shifting from the mind to the constantness, shifting from the mind to the consistency, noticing I'm lost in mind again and shifting again. Yeah, Kanan is saying, "My biggest fear was of actually experiencing the mindless state. The ego's terrified of it because everything, including the world, disappears in the mindless state." All right, so tell you what, let's go on to the next journal entry, which is 6:44, so I'm going to scroll down and click on 6:44. I'm going to start by reading quote number 6:44 in the Seven Steps to Awakening. "The notions of I and mine are the eager receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering. He who identifies the body with the self sinks in misery." You know, it's funny if you listen to the statement, "Woe is me." There has to be a me for that woe is to fall upon. Right? Woe is me. In order for there to be a woe is me, there has to be a me. That's what this quote seems to be saying. "The notions of I and mine are the ego receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering." I and mine are the eager receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering. Funny how willing we are for the woe is me. Why is that? I mean, have you ever asked? I mean, most of us would say, you know, like if we were in an interview and we were being asked questions, you know, and the, one of the questions was, "Do you prefer to be happy or miserable?" Most of us would say, happy. That's what most humans would say. I prefer to be happy. And yet, so many of us seem to continue to choose miserable. Why do we do that? Have you ever asked yourself why you accept the woe is me thought? This says, the notions of I and mine are the eager receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering. I used to have a friend who lived with me who could get very angry. I used to say I was an expert at anger. Okay, so take one of my biggest anger fits and go ahead and multiply that, you know, by three or four at least. And this was the anger that she would engage in. And as I observed her engaging in this strong, strong anger, what I realized was there was something in her, obviously the ego. It felt alive and empowered in that anger. Like the ego felt strong and real. The notions of I and mine are the eager receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering. Well, maybe that's also true. You know, I said her anger made her somehow feel strong and empowered and real. Maybe the victim stories do the same thing. Have you ever looked to see if maybe there's this feeling of attention on me when I'm the victim? Woe is me calls attention to me from others, and that makes me feel very here, very real, very meaningful. The ego, of course. But don't you think it's worth looking at why, if on an interview, if asked, would you rather be happy or miserable? Why, you know, we would all answer happy, so why do we choose misery so often? Don't you think it's worth looking at? Questioning? Maybe bringing a bit of wisdom insight to that process. You know, a lot of us may not even notice that we are choosing woe is me. At some point, you know, I remember when I first started the spiritual path and I was taught about thoughts and their effect on me, I didn't believe it. I thought, that's not true. I just get angry. I don't have a thought that makes me angry. I just get angry. It just happens. But as I was willing to become more subtle and paying attention, I learned there was a thought. And not only that, that thought had a deeper meaning that I was believing. You know, and I came to see there was a lot more going on in the mind, and I was choosing to believe it. I really was. And I was choosing to listen. And this was great, great, great news, because if I was the one choosing to believe these thoughts, choosing to listen to them, I could actually begin to make another choice. I could begin to choose not to listen. I mean, my freedom lied in realizing that I was the one choosing to believe, for example, woe is me. But some of us even need to ask, what do I think I'm getting out of choosing, for example, woe is me? What is it that I think I'm getting? You know, attention from others, for example. And then maybe we need to look at that and say, you know, is that what I really want? Do I really want to suffer in order to get this perceived attention, in order to feel more valuable? Do I want to feel more valuable through suffering? You know, we need to begin to question this. And if we really look at it with our wisdom, since we do know that we want to be happy, that's why we would all answer the interview that way. Maybe if we start to really look at what we're doing, we'll start to make different choices. You know, we'll see that woe is me thought coming in at some point, and then we'll say, ah, there's that thought, but, you know, I know what's going to happen if I go down that road, and I just don't want that. You know, and in the beginning, it's a lot like, you know, I can't understand this circumstance. I don't know why this is happening, but you know what? I choose to just be in acceptance and trust here instead of woe is me. That's how it starts. I just choose to be in acceptance and trust and see what's going to happen next rather than woe is me, because I don't want woe is me anymore. And again, the woe is me, the anger, all of those types of thoughts really boost the ego. They make the ego feel strong and real. The notions of I and mine are the eager receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering. He who identifies the body with the self sinks in misery. And so as long as we want that ego self to feel strong, we're going to buy into those thoughts that cause unhappiness. It goes hand in hand. So let's go have a look at the journal. Number 644 in the journal says, "What do I call mine? What is temporary that I strongly identify with that has the potential for causing suffering because of the idea mine?" So I mentioned to you all earlier that sometimes when I'm contemplating the quotes, what begins to happen is an inquiry. And this inner inquiry is a looking at me. You know, I just suggested a moment ago that maybe some people want to begin to look at themselves, begin to look at, you know, why they choose woe is me, for example. Well, that's what's happening for me when I look at this. I'm beginning to look at me. I'm reading the quote. I'm contemplating the quote. And then I'm saying, okay, where is it where I'm still attached, where suffering could happen? You know, like what if my house burnt down? Am I so attached to my house and my things in my house? If my house burnt down, I would suffer. You know, what about my daughter? My dog? Am I so attached that something can happen with them where I would really, really, really suffer? What about my own, this body right here? You know, what if I lost an arm, lost a leg, lost my sight? You know, this is looking to see where am I still identified through that idea of mine? That if something happens in a way that seems different than what the mind sets up as the conditions for happiness, because the mind has conditions for happiness, it allows happiness if everything meets those conditions, right? So where could something happen that's different than the mind's conditions of happiness? And because I'm so attached to mind, I now then am an eager receptacle for sorrow or suffering. This was the questioning. So what do I call mine? What is temporary? And by the way, this house is temporary. My daughter and my dog are temporary. This body is temporary. All of those things are temporary. Something could happen to any one of them at any point. We don't like to think about those things, but we all know that it's true. What is temporary that I strongly identify with that has the potential for causing suffering because of the idea mine? So this is looking. You know, one thing I've mentioned before, I'm sure, during Seven Steps teachings, is that the mind likes to pretend like we are more enlightened than we are, especially when everything is going well. That's a wonderful time to pretend. You know, I'm so enlightened, I'm so happy. You know, I can drop an egg on the floor and not get mad. But I think it's wonderful to be honest. I think it's wonderful to look and say, you know, there are probably still places where I'm strongly identified with I and mine. And as a result, there's a potential for great suffering there. Often, I feel like a beginner all over again. In fact, just right now, I'm going through that process. And I remember when I first started this spiritual path, someone telling me that frequently he would go back to step one. You know, he just felt like he was starting all over again. I feel the same way. In fact, one of the classes that I have been teaching lately is a class on Sufism. And in that class, one of the chapters is about what's called doubling back. Doubling back, you know, where we, you know, we work through something and we really feel at some point we seem to emerge from that, and there's this feeling of, you know, maybe having transcended it or something. And then months later or years later, we find there we are again, and we're letting go again. What's interesting about the way this is presented, though, in the Sufi path, is that this is presented as progress. All doubling back is a part of progress. You know, many of us want to feel like it's some kind of failure, but it's presented as progress every time we double back. And that reminds me of A Course in Miracles. Jesus says we do not know our retreats from our advances. Because again, many of these things that feel like retreats, these doubling backs, are actually progress. And we think they're retreats, but they're advances. Sikkhananda says, reminds me of, quote, 574. There are so many who take the dawn for the noon, a momentary experience for full realization, and destroy even the little they gain by excess of pride. Nisargadatta Maharaj. Another thing that the doubling back teaching reminds me of is Peace Pilgrim's teaching. I always seem to double back to her, don't I? She was my first spiritual inspiration, and apparently a good one, because I'm always going back to what she said. But, you know, she talked about those hills and valleys. Hills and valleys. And she said that the hilltops, that's really when we are maybe feeling clearer. Maybe we even are feeling more enlightened at that point. We seem to be in the flow. We're easily happy and joyous. You know, something happens, we're just dealing with it, you know, and it's really, it's wonderful. We all like it because, again, on the interview, we would choose happy. And this is a happy time up here on these hilltops. But then she says, after every hilltop, there's another valley. The valley is when we seem to fall back down into the ego. The valley is, you know, what the Sufis would call doubling back. What Jesus in A Course in Miracles would call an advance that we're perceiving as a retreat, right? And Peace Pilgrim said the reason we go into the valleys, she says, is to learn another lesson. You know, kind of like the Course, all things are lessons God would have me learn. You know, my language would be the reason we go back into the valley is so that we can let go of ego more, let go of more attachment to thinking, let go of more believing, let go of more valuing the valueless. And Peace pointed out that these valleys were very, very important to the spiritual path. I mean, I'm just going to make up a story here for an image. So what I'm about to say is a lie. Do not believe it. But let's imagine that there are 75 hilltops you have to cross before you get to the mountaintop of enlightenment. And let's imagine that we each have to go on all 75 hilltops before we can get to the mountain of enlightenment. But between each and every hilltop, there's a valley. Do you really want to go up on the first hilltop and then stay there? You're still 74 hilltops away from enlightenment if you do that. Don't we want to make the full journey? Which means we go up on a hilltop, then we walk down into the valley, then up on the next hilltop, and then down into the valley, and then up on the next hilltop until we've crossed all 75 hilltops as well as all 75 valleys, and we finally reach the mountain of enlightenment. Why be afraid of doubling back if it's actually progress toward that which we say we seek? All right, I'm going to look at the journal entry for 644. I haven't finished this yet. I started it. And what's happening here, as you know, is looking. But I haven't finished reading even the journal entry, so let's look at it again. What do I call mine? What is temporary that I strongly identify with that has the potential for causing suffering because of the idea mine? Do I judge that I love more in circumstances where I see a potential for suffering than in circumstances where I do not imagine that potential? Is there a belief that if I do not suffer in certain circumstances, there is not enough closeness or enough love? Now, that's a very interesting question because some people believe this. Some people believe, and Byron Katie often talks about this. in her funny way. But, you know, some people believe, well, I'm going to go ahead and just use Monica as an example. Monica's here in the room. Physically, Monica has been going through a heck of a lot lately. She's had, I think, 2 brain surgeries. Is that right, Monica? Has had some paralyzation, paralysis, and I don't even really know what all. 3 brain surgeries. Okay, 3 brains. And it's been, what, about a year since all of this has started? Maybe not even a year. And I love Monica. I love Monica. I've known Monica a long time, and I really love her. And sometimes what the mind tells us is in order for me to love Monica, I have to suffer. I have to suffer. I have to say, oh, Monica, 3 brain surgeries. Oh, that must be terrible. Oh, you're having trouble finding someone to give you a ride. Oh, that must be terrible, right? The mind tries to tell us that is love, that suffering is necessary for the love to be valid. And this is something that I wanted to look at. Is that true? Do I have to suffer with Monica in order to love her? Did I have to suffer with Cheryl Valentine when she was dying of brain tumor with great pain in order to love her? Did I have to suffer? And what I found was, no, I don't. You know, I found that I could have some really wonderful, direct conversations with Cheryl because I chose not to suffer with her. And I also found that I loved her very, very much and that she knew that. And when I saw Monica in New York City, you know, I was just happy to see her. I mean, sure, she was in a wheelchair and somebody was pushing her around and she had this scarf on her head because her head's full of steel stitches, and we even talked about that. But I was able just to look at her and love her and be happy. So the question that's happening in the inquiry now, because remember the quote is saying that the notions of I and mind are receptacles, like vessels that receive sorrow and suffering. And so what I'm really looking at in this inquiry is I'm asking, do I want to empower my I so much that I feel that in order to love in some circumstances, I must suffer? Is this one of the ways that I'm a vessel for suffering because of this belief in personhood, right? That's what that would be, a belief in personhood. And so this is just an inquiry. This is just a looking. Do I judge that I love more in circumstances where I see a potential for suffering than in circumstances where I do not imagine that potential? That's a different question, so I'll come back to that. The one I just discussed was the second question. Is there a belief that if I do not suffer in certain circumstances, that is not enough closeness or enough love? Lots of people believe this. The I, the mind, believes this. M-I-N-E, mind. Also the M-I-N-D, mind. But we're here, we're talking about the I and the mind. Is there a belief that if I do not suffer in certain circumstances, there is not enough closeness or enough love? I need to look at this. Because if I do have that belief, what's really being fed through that belief is the ego. Let's go back to this first question. I didn't talk about it. Do I judge that I love more in the circumstances where I see a potential for suffering than in circumstances where I do not imagine that potential? Funny, right this moment, maybe the reason I was able to come up with an example for the second question is because Monica was here, so my eyes could land on her and I could come up with an example. right this second. I can't come up with an example for the first question, but I do know that I used to have this belief, you know, like, gosh, I'm just going to have to use somebody else because I can't remember me specifically. But I know someone who had teenage children, and every time those teenage children went out, she would fret and worry and fret and worry and fret and worry about what might happen to them while they're out. And somebody talked to her about that and suggested that she give up that fretting and worrying while her children were out and just be. And she literally said, I'm afraid if I don't worry about them, I won't appreciate them. I'm afraid if I don't worry about them, if I don't realize how they could be taken away from me, that I won't appreciate them. She thought she had to fret and worry and imagine that they might be killed in a car wreck tonight while they're out with their friends in order to value them. Isn't that a crazy belief? But I bet if you've never looked at it before, I bet if you just tune in your awareness to see if that ever shows up for you, you might find out it's in there. Because this I and mine are eager receptacles for suffering. This is how they feel boosted. And so they literally look for ways to suffer. Imagine that. The I and mine beliefs, also the me belief, which is the same thing, literally looks for ways to suffer. You know, so how am I boosting my ego by believing these ideas that suffering equals love? I'm going to start at the top again, but again, we still haven't gotten through all of the inquiries that are happening in 644, so let's just continue reading. What do I call mine? What is temporary that I strongly identify with that has the potential for causing suffering because of the idea mine? Do I judge that I love more in circumstances where I see a potential for suffering than in circumstances where I do not imagine that potential? Is there a belief that if I do not suffer in certain circumstances, there is not enough closeness or enough love? So these are inquiries that I was asking myself as I was contemplating this quote. And then I said, yes, I believe love would suffer in some circumstances. And if there is no suffering, it means there is no love. Also, I see myself as guilty for not loving enough in those circumstances. And then I just wrote, this is a belief that needs to be looked at. Of course, this was in November 13, 2012. And I think I've definitely made progress on this in this particular area. Sometimes when I read my journal, it's funny. I can see, oh my gosh, here I am 3 years later. I haven't made any progress on that one yet. Time to double back, right? And then other times I look at something in my journal and I say, oh, I think there has been progress on that one. But who knows, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe at some point in the future I'll double back. Yeah, Regis is writing, this is why some people grieve. They believe if they don't, that they didn't love the person. One friend of ours, he lost his wife, some months ago, I think it was in the fall, to a brain aneurysm, very, very sudden. Like one moment, everything is fine. And the next moment, there's a brain aneurysm, rushed to the hospital, and then death. And I think he did experience a bit of mourning. He talks about realizing he needed to be alone. But as he went through this mourning, I think, you know, compared to what other humans would consider normal, his mourning was extremely brief. In fact, it ended well before the funeral. The mourning ended, the grieving ended well before the funeral. I mean, I don't know. I didn't ask him exactly how many hours it was, but I know that it ended before the funeral. What began to happen is he began to set and look at the relationship in the way that he did, as he began to just feel great gratitude and love for having had the relationship. And he said that's the only thing that he could really experience now was gratitude. gratitude and love. How can we say gratitude and love is not love? Why would we say you have to grieve to love? Why isn't, you know, this relationship has ended now. We know that these relationships are all temporary, every single one of them. So when they end, and Nisargadatta, I read Nisargadatta once say that some grieving is normal. You know, when you lose a close relationship, that can happen. But if it's too extended, he said, it's for selfish reasons. Well, I and mine are pretty selfish, aren't they? You know, I'm imagining, oh, I'll never get to hike in the mountains with this person again. I'll never get to see her face again. I'll never get to. How selfish is that? Think about it. Grieving comes from this I and mind who are eager receptacles to receive sorrow and suffering. Yeah, what this person saw was that when he really sat down and looked at the relationship in the hours after the death, that he found gratitude and love. That is, gratitude and love are love, aren't they? Gratitude and love, it feels like love to me. Yeah, it feels like love to me. So again, we have 3 minutes left, so let me just read the Yoga Vasistha quote one more time and read the journal one more time. The notions of I and mine are the eager receptacles which receive sorrow and suffering. He who identifies the body with the self sinks in misery. And again, my theory is this is because the ego is strengthened through that woe is me. Right? There's a very strong me in victimhood. There's a very strong me in the idea I have lost something. There's a very strong me in the idea I am sacrificing. There's a very strong me and I have been treated unfairly. There's a very strong me and I am being ignored. I am not getting respect. Right? All of these things. The me is so strong. So the ego is literally strengthened through these thoughts. And again, the journal is nothing but a little bit of looking. This isn't even a lot of looking. A little bit of looking that came on November 13th, 2012 when I was contemplating this, where I began to look to see, am I still strengthening the ego through the belief in suffering? Through the belief that I need suffering, that suffering is necessary, or I'm not a loving human being. Here are some of the questions that were asked. What do I call mine? What is temporary that I strongly identify with that has the potential for causing suffering because of the idea, mine? Again, the death of the dog, for example. I'll never get to take walks with her again. I'll never get to pet her again. I'll never, it's all about me. I. Do I judge that I love more in circumstances where I see a potential for suffering than in circumstances where I do not imagine that potential? Like the mother I talked about who did not want to give up worry because she was afraid if she did not worry and imagine the worst for her children, that she would not value them. She wanted to love her children, so she imagined that she needed to be this worried mother. Is there a belief that I do not suffer in certain circumstances, there is not enough closeness or enough love? Do I believe I have to suffer over Monica's circumstance in order to love Monica? That without the suffering, I'm not loving. I don't know who this person is, a UB, a UB8, But it says Ellie Rudzar. Oh, hold on. This is probably Nikki because she's calling in for the ordination. Hey, Nikki, I'm just finishing the 7 steps teaching, so just hang on.
Okay.
Ellie Rudzar said she cried when she found out one of her friends passed away, but she did not suffer. Okay, so the next question, or actually the answer to the questions in the journal is yes, yes, I believe love, this is a belief, I believe love would suffer in some circumstances, and if there is no suffering, it means there is no love. Also, I see myself as guilty for not loving enough in those circumstances. This is a belief that needs to be looked at. So that concludes the 7 steps teaching for this evening.